I always preach change is good. Change creates more optionality.
Welcome in to another episode of the Professional Profiles podcast that uncovers the time-tested wisdom for the next generation. Join me, a forward-thinking teen, as I engage in insightful conversations with industry titans, revealing the invaluable ingredients that pave the way to achieving remarkable success. Today, I'm so lucky to introduce a decent golfer, but an incredible human, Mr. Bryce Englert. He is the founder and CEO of Trade Pending, a company that simplifies the automotive buying process, that boasts an employee count of over 150 individuals, and generates an estimated annual revenue of $40 million. Bryce went to Vanderbilt University for his undergrad, served in the U.S. Air Force, then moved into various positions in the business world. Then he earned his MBA at the University of Texas, then moved on to found his company in 2015. You may notice Bryce's voice is strikingly similar to Ted Lasso, and I can assure you that he looks the part as well. Anyways, I really hope you enjoyed this conversation with the super knowledgeable Bryce Englert. He was a blast to have on, and I look forward to talking with him again in the future. So thank you and enjoy. Hey, Charlie here. I just want to take a brief moment to let y'all know about the Profiles newsletter, which condenses all the proven methods, tactics, and ideas used by world-class successes that you can use to level up your life. Each week, I send out a non-spammy email with all the insights I've gleaned from the Profiles podcast, condensed down into a very, very short article filled with the absolute best advice. You can sign up below using the link in the description, or you can visit charliehubbard.substack.com. Again, that's charliehubbard.substack.com. That's all from me. Here's the interview. Bryce, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time. I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
Charlie, my pleasure. Excited for the conversation.
So just to start us off, I'd love for you to tell us what your career trajectory has kind of looked like. You can do the oversimplified version, but kind of how it's been for you to where you are today.
Sure. Yeah. No. So I'm 20 plus years into my career, and it's taken a few different turns that really gave me an opportunity to land where I am. You know, if you go way back, I've studied electrical engineering in undergrad, mainly because the Air Force was giving away scholarships. So I wanted to go to Vanderbilt and needed to figure out a way to get that paid for. So declared myself an electrical engineer, and turns out that I was a pretty average engineer. So back in the 90s, I was kind of software-ish, but served in the Air Force and ran software programs in the late 90s. And went back to school at Texas, Hookem, and studied finance and got my MBA there, really to try to gain more knowledge around just, general business, administration. I always had kind of, curiosity from an entrepreneurial side, but I thought that would be, really, good to kind of diversify my experience. And it did ultimately land me into the automotive industry in 2006. And I worked for a very large company that was doing quite a bit of M&A work. So we bought, I think, 8 companies in 2 years, automotive specific vendors, data companies, all software companies, helping dealerships and OEMs kind of sell vehicles and a few other things, which led me to find my real passion in kind of product management. I took one product management course, and I'm certainly not a product manager, but I loved what I learned in engineering, looking at a problem and trying to solve it in a unique way. And that kind of metastasized into a few funny things that I loved to do. I loved writing business plans, and didn't have to make them long, detailed, short, but just think of an idea, document things, around. And I think I really applied myself as a student of this automotive industry for the 10 years that I was with this larger company to mitigate a lot of risk if and when I had the opportunity to go start my own thing. And then in 2014, started a little company called Trade Pending and put all my energy behind it. I had no tolerance to moonlight and things like that. I needed to do this 110%. And 10 years later now, here we are, 150 employees or so, and it's still working out.
So your story, a message that I'm taking away is the idea of preserving optionality for as long as possible. And you gained this skill set and these different skill sets through different stages in your career. So I'd like you to talk, if you could, about the role of preserving optionality and how that's played out in your career.
100%. So I think you got to be true to what you find interesting, first of all. Too many careers are born out of a little bit of, you know, necessity, and folks don't recognize the different exposure you can create for yourself into the organization, volunteering for a tough role and getting exposure into different departments, you know, making switches. I always preach change is good. Change creates more optionality. If you stay in one field, say sales, for your entire career, you probably can be a great salesperson. You could probably make a great living. But I know I've loved to see folks on my team kind of switch over to, say, product management, or, you know, take on different departmental challenges. So for me, you know, switching from the Air Force into graduate school, I had a stint in financial services that I felt just wasn't the right fit, you know, right time. Doing M&A work, moving into operations, running one of the companies that we'd purchased, it created a diversified view of, you know, what I love to do, and it gave me the optionality in the end, you know, to found a company. Never burn bridges. Be respectful to the teams around you. Put your people first. If they're successful, you're successful. And all of that, I think, has helped me build a great team today.
Amazing. So I'd love to talk about business a little bit later, but yep. Focus in on your time in the Air Force. So could you talk about that experience and kind of the insights that you gleaned from it?
Sure. I was talking to some colleagues just the other day on this, and genuine, you know, answer. My experience initially, I was not excited to be in the Air Force. And I think it was a little bit of immaturity. I had recognized an opportunity, but I had a lot of friends who were joining .com companies in the late 90s and, you know, living it up in San Francisco and, you know, making more money than I was as a second lieutenant in the Air Force. And so for whatever reason, I felt like I was a little bit chained into that. And probably 9 months in, my professional attitude was completely changed when had a guy, his name was Captain Ken Krantz. He came in and he was focused, he was diligent, he was experienced, and he was very, very dedicated to the mission that we were doing. And I remember him sitting me down and saying, hey, you know, you've got this opportunity and you can do it one of two ways. And I've had this throughout my life a few times. It's great when you have, you know, a mentor, just somebody reminding you like, hey, put your energy behind anything and you can make it a success. And so I remember that exact moment. And from there, I really learned how to be a good software program manager. And I learned my skills, not in writing software, you know, leading developers a little bit, but my real strengths were collaborating with the different parties to build the tools that we deployed into different exercise environments, and really found a lot of satisfaction in it. Once I buckled down and said, you know what, this is a unique opportunity. And honestly, you know, 25 years later, the things I was doing in 1998, 1999, once I found my focus, are still very similar to what I do today as CEO guy at Trade Pending.
So what did that teach you about teamwork? Because I imagine you had that camaraderie with your colleagues and your time there. So what did you learn about leadership and teamwork?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, looking back, I was really blessed to have the opportunity to serve in the Air Force. Not just for basic military service. You know, I had a lot of friends who had cooler jobs in the Army as a Ranger and, you know, blowing things up. But for me, you know, teamwork really was important, because as we were going to big joint exercises, we'd bring hundreds and hundreds of people together for 7-day exercises, 24 hours a day, with modeling and simulation tools communicating to each other. And if one thing went wrong, you had to quickly collaborate, you know, with your team to fix things, but also with the other teams to be able to get things back on track. So relationships were key, and, you know, being open to working with different styles of folks. Engineers can sometimes be different than lieutenant colonels who were kind of sponsoring the exercise and things like that. And so I think I developed a very good sense of being a dependable member of the team, you know, that was flexible to you know, take on whatever the task was, you know, and even if I was kind of unqualified for it, I'd try to learn from the senior folks. You know, the interesting thing about the Air Force too is, you know, I'm a junior officer. I know very little, you know, but you've got senior enlisted folks, you know, that have 15, you know, plus years experience. And just because you outrank someone doesn't mean that you can't learn a lot from them. And that happens in business every day. It happens, I think, in college every day, you know, recognize that that the team is going to be balanced by different levels of experience and in rank and title, but that doesn't matter. You know, you've got to get the mission done.
So I'd love to transition now to your work and role as the CEO of Trade Pending. So sure. How do you structure and build your team? Because you now have over 150 employees. So how are you finding the people that you know are going to do the best for the company in terms of leadership and just building an overall functioning team?
Very germane to what is going on with Trade Pending today, by the way. And so there's probably three phases, you know, that we could break down. So, you know, one, with any startup software company of sorts, you know, you've got to surround yourself with people that are very comfortable in a fast-paced environment that recognize, you know, the risks that you have. And it just takes a lot of focus and effort on getting through that first phase of entrepreneurialism, which is finding product market fit. And so the people that that joined me early on, I was incredibly blessed with their comfort level and being small, very small. And, you know, we reached our, I think, 150 customers with three people on the team entirely, which was great. But that first phase of, you know, just launching a product and then gaining customers, sales is incredibly important. And we put a lot of effort behind sales as well as developing our product to make sure that it was kind of sustainable and not only proven market fit, but it had kind of universal appeal, global appeal to all of our target customer base. And we stayed as small as we could for as long as we could. So that was phase one. I was not VC backed. I didn't really want to take in institutional money. And so, you know, the term bootstrapped is exactly kind of how we approached it, which was, hey, we're going to pick ourselves by the boots. One of my stories were the early on there, I had a limited budget to travel, but I needed to go visit a lot of customers and auto dealerships are everywhere. So I bought a used Ford Focus with a really bad transmission because it was the cheapest way for me to get to point A to point B and C and D and put about 50,000 miles on it in the first year. But that's what was needed, you know, and what my core skill. But that first phase, you know, I always look back on fondly, and there's a lot of ways to do it. You know, you could have got more capital, hire bigger teams, but we chose to be very lean and challenge ourselves to break even, which only took us about 14 months. So we were kind of cash flow independent and didn't have to go back to the market to raise money. And then I think the second phase, you know, really was, you know, scaling at a different level where you've got to prove that you're not a single product company, right? You have multiple problems you're solving for your target customer base. And we did so and had three successful product launches over the next, you know, 5 years. So call it 2020-ish. And with that phase, you know, we started scaling, building systems that helped automate folks, workflows, you know, launching more products, you know, creating more addressable market for ourselves. One of our constraints with one product is your addressable market, you know, was about 100 million. So if we succeeded and got 10% of that, we're a $10 million company. But as any good product manager knows, if you layer on more products, product life cycles on top of each other, you can expand that addressable market, which then, you know, adds more fuel to your possible growth fire. So we did that well and didn't raise any money and got to kind of the opportunity where we had phase three, which in December 2020 took in some private equity money and had a good reason to do that to kind of continue our growth trajectory and found a good partner that helped us kind of go back to my roots, actually, which was, you know, to do some mergers and acquisitions work. And over the last 3 years with private equity money and institutional capital, we bought three companies. We've integrated those teams into our own. And I think 3 years ago, we were probably 40 people. So if you fast forward, we've continued to grow organically, plus the things that we bought. And that phase has been incredibly challenging, which is one reason I think I wanted to do it. It just adds a whole element of complexity. But it's been very rewarding as well. And that sets us up now for, frankly, the next phase, which is, well, where do you go from here? How do you continue to grow? And we've got a good collection of assets, great experienced team. And back to your question, sorry to be lengthy with my response, but the type of people that we have today are very different than what we needed when we got started. So, you know, people that are comfortable with, you know, more process, you know, the larger organization. We're not a big company. We want to still behave like a small agile company. But the people that we have, you know, our eyes on now have been there and done that. They've built customer success teams. They have built go-to-market in a very complex sales environment. So you mature. Hopefully you mature. You know, if you stay the same, then it's just then it's just kind of a lifestyle business, which was not necessarily my goal.
So you just mentioned risk, and I'm curious to hear how you built Trade Pending while still having to support your family. So how did you, or why did you take this leap of faith, and how did you mitigate risk along the journey?
Man, good question, dude. So my short answer is that I worked in the industry with a larger company and with a great job and gained exposure to a lot of different companies and models. And so I was mitigating my eventual entrepreneurial risk by waiting until I was 38 or whatever it was when I started Trade Pending. So at the time, I think I was calculating, you know, that risk, and recognized with more experience, you know, I could have the intelligence to make fewer poor decisions. And I remember, actually, I was at South by Southwest Interactive in like 2012 before I started Trade Pending, and somebody had a session where they showed a graph of the age of founders versus the success rate of the companies that they founded, and the least percent chance of ultimate success, however that was defined, was the, you know, 20 to 25 year old, you know, crazy entrepreneurs. Now there's some great unicorn stories, you know, with the Zuckerbergs and the whatnots of folks who've done that really successfully, but the highest percent chance of success was, I think, from age like 38 to 42. If I recall. And I took that to heart. I was like, man, okay. Like, you know, if I have a window, it's A, when I've saved enough money to take some risk. And as I told my wife at the time, I said, I promise if this doesn't work, I'll go get a real job again. So I made a commitment, and I was able to, you know, define a few years and define the risk that I was taking. And I was devoted to the fact that, hey, you know what, if it doesn't work out, then you just, you know, get back on management track and enjoy my career. Luckily, it's worked out, so I still don't have a real job.
So last time we talked, you gave me some very simple but profound entrepreneurial advice, which is to identify a problem. And no matter how small or how big, it's the identification of the problem and then working to solve it that leads to entrepreneurial success. So could you speak about this point and maybe share what you meant by that?
Totally. And that was my 1 week course in product management. I had some profound takeaways. And one was that, you know, product management is a very broad field. We're all product managers in some ways. I think, Charlie, you're a product manager. You're solving a problem for your listeners today who maybe don't know, you know, how to focus, you know, in what they want to study, or how to create optionality, or it's okay to be flexible with your career and your career aspirations, you know, navigate through that. And every product is solving a problem. This cup is solving a problem to drink this coffee. It's insulated. I can put it in the microwave. I can't do that with a glass, so on and so forth, right? And in software, the beautiful thing about software is how quickly you can identify and solve problems to automate things and create new routines and just entirely new things, which really attracted me to software, because you can be quick at identifying that. So not every problem, you know, creates an addressable market, i.e. Not every problem that you can solve creates a financial opportunity to build revenue and grow a company. So I think you've got to be a little bit true to that sometimes and not fall in love with a singular problem that you're trying to solve. But if you looked at the world like that and combine that with experience and getting to know an industry, a category of solutions, you know, what does a, you know, financial advisor do? Well, they solve problems for folks to establish goals and work to achieve those goals over time, to have, you know, financial independence one day, to retire, things like that. So we're all product managing something, and everything that we're really working for is to try to solve a problem. So if you look at that through the lens, like take golf, you know, what's the problem you solve every day as a golfer? Shooting lower. How do you shoot lower? Repetition, practice, you know, and the problem is great. That's why I love golf myself, because I think the problem is so easy. You're just focusing on, you know, one good shot after another. And then guess how many times you hit a good shot in a round? Not many. Yeah, but it only takes a few to make you feel pretty darn good when you solve that problem really well, right?
For sure. I'd love to jump back into hearing your motivation behind choosing to pursue your MBA after your stint in the Air Force. So what was the reasoning behind that?
So I loved my scholarship in engineering. I figured out I was an average engineer. And then I figured out kind of the business application of being around an engineering environment. And in the end, kind of liked business development. The optionality that I'd created through that was actually pretty good. I could have stayed in the Air Force and joined the F-22 program working on the avionics, which was unbelievable. It was this really expensive helmet that had like retina detection for weapon systems deployment and all sorts of crazy stuff. But it was super technical, and that wasn't my passion. So I needed to create more optionality. And so I thought going back for a full-time MBA would allow me to study things that I didn't study in undergrad that interested me, whether it was, you know, finance. Believe it or not, I had some interest in accounting. Accounting makes, you know, commercial businesses run, whether you're a dentist or, you know, a golf equipment manufacturer. So going back to business school really was that opportunity for me to create more optionality and experience. So I wanted to be part of a community I felt that was very creative, and UT's MBA program had kind of a great reputation from an entrepreneurial perspective. Some really great professors and teachers. Jay Hartzell, who's actually the provost or the main guy there at UT now, he's president, and he was our accounting professor back in the early 2000s. It was just a great environment, and if you look at all my peers, it was an amazing group of hundreds of people. You know, that if you looked at their careers today, a lot of folks have started companies. A lot of folks are, you know, have really excelled in their careers, and putting myself in that group of aspirational people was very exciting for me at the time too.
For sure. What were your interests coming out of high school? So what were you interested in pursuing?
Man. Well, back in my day, it was a little different. And you know, I clearly remember I went to high school in Kentucky at Model Lab School in Richmond, Kentucky. And we were probably one of the quote unquote best schools in the state. But I think that was mainly because we were a lot of professor children. And it was small. Most folks, I think I was the only person in my high school class of 50 something people that went to undergrad out of state. And I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville. I had an older sister who was an achiever. She went to the U.S. The Air Force Academy, and I really respected kind of the challenge that she put in front of her. So I'd say that I knew that I was technically inclined. I liked math. I was English challenged. I won't even tell you when I got on my SAT. You'd laugh, but it was just wasn't my thing, and it was something that I had to improve on greatly. In graduate school and then also in business life. But I just had enough of an inkling to know that I wanted to go to Vanderbilt. I wanted to go to a good school. And back then, perhaps it was a little bit easier to get into than today. And I felt like engineering, you know, would be interesting. And then once I learned there were scholarships in electrical engineering, I said, you know what, I'm in. But architecture, I thought architecture was cool. You know, I just had just enough of a creative side, you know, to think building things was interesting. I looked at Rice University. I don't think I got in there, but they had a cool architecture school, and those kids worked really hard. So I didn't feel like I had to define, you know, specifically everything that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I just had, you know, and that's the way we used to be able to do it, I guess, 25 years ago. But I felt very super comfortable that I could get on the journey, you know, check a couple of the priority boxes that I felt, you know, good school, engineering school, scholarship opportunity, check, check, check. And the great thing about actually doing ROTC was I was guaranteed a job. You know, I knew where I was going to land, even though I may have had a little confusion, you know, on the get-go, how I could affect it positively. It was incredibly valuable in the end.
For sure. And then transitioning now into undergrad, when you major in electrical engineering, how did the engineering mindset play into your career down the line? Like solving problems and thinking creatively.
So I clearly remember some courses that I enjoyed more than others. So back in the day, we called things informatics, and that was a core class that was focused on using cold fusion to develop a business idea. Me and a buddy came up with an idea for road tripping, you know, which was like a social media play for how to share, you know, road trips and routes, and people could follow you and things like that. This is way before social media. And I love the creative kind of development of the idea and plan, but we had to develop it. And that's where I fell completely on my face. and I think I had just good enough of a lab partner, you know, to kind of create a B, you know, in the end for the product that we'd created or the website that we'd created for it. But I clearly remember, you know, that, you know, that type of product management, even I didn't even know it was product management, you know, early on. You know, it was just, you know, taking a challenge, which at the time, you know, we'd go on road trips to Georgia for a football game. And, you know, we didn't have GPS even back then. Right. So where do you go? Where do you stay? You know, what's the cheapest place to get some chicken or whatever, you know, anything, you know, when I arrive in Athens, that was actually kind of hard to figure out back then. So I love that. And then I remember a couple courses that I just, you know, was not attuned to, circuits. Boy, I couldn't figure those circuits out, you know, which I had some good lab partners that helped me out quite a bit. And I think that that's just part of the journey, you know. And I stayed for a fifth year. I picked up my scholarship my second year, so it was a four-year scholarship. And I took the time to take, you know, Fine Arts 101 as a fifth year, which was totally a weird combination, but I felt it was just kind of fascinating to learn about Da Vinci and all the interesting creators of things back then. So to your generation, I think it's a decent, you know, advice to say, hey, even if you choose a track, if it's engineering, if it's, you know, business or finance or whatever it is, challenge yourself and go take, you know, a course that's not your discipline, because I can promise you it all kind of works together somehow.
Amazing advice. So as we kind of wrap up our interview, I have three more abstract questions that I'd love you to answer. The first one being the billboard question. So if you're given the opportunity to place a phrase, quote, or idea on a billboard in front of millions of eyes, what would you choose to put on it and why would you choose it?
Oh man, goodness. That's a tough one. You know, probably, and I don't even have a catchphrase that I use with folks. but off the top of my mind, be true and be daring, you know, kind of thing, which is, you know, true to yourself. If you're passionate about it, you're going to do incredibly well. And be daring, you know, is just to say, hey, challenge yourself every day. And that doesn't mean, you know, just go start a company. It means that, you know what, you know, help out somebody else in a different department, volunteer, you know, for some extra time to gain exposure to other people or other projects and things. So I suppose that'd be it. Yeah.
Okay.
Be true, be daring.
I like it. Next would be, you're given 10 minutes notice to give a TED talk. What are you choosing to talk about and why?
I've done this before.
Really?
I didn't get 10 minutes. No. But I have to tell the story. So I had a customer invite us to come into Columbus, Ohio and give a TED talk presentation to kind of their management team, which was like 20 different dealerships. And I think a lot of the other vendors, took kind of the boring approach of just giving a demonstration about like, you know, why social media advertising works in automotive or something like that. But I took it to heart. And so my TED talk was trying to educate about a fascinating historical story of the city of, the settlement of Astoria back in the mid 1600s, which was the first Western settlement in the U.S. And a guy named John Jacob Astor partnered with a guy named Thomas Jefferson to establish these trade routes to ultimately end at the mouth of the Columbia River, where modern day Washington State meets Oregon. And they set up this settlement called Astoria. And so the book was fantastic. I highly recommend it because it's one of those adventure stories. This was after Lewis and Clark had kind of, you know, done some things out west. And I tell this story to this group of dealerships, and they're thinking to myself, why is he educating me on, you know, the trials and tribulations of this Western settlement? But in that book, I extracted kind of, you know, five key messages, you know, that you can learn from early exploration, you know, the harder the journey, you know, the fewer the survivors or something like that. Anyhow, there was these key lessons, but then I related it into the problems that our company is trying to solve for our customer base. So I love TED Talks, and I would always approach those. And today, me and a few folks in the company, we kind of challenge ourselves to figure out, you know, some type of historical lesson. We just had one that my marketing guy did on like the dumbest wars ever fought. And he talked about the war of Jenkins' ear and this and that. But then you can draw parallels, lessons learned into that to kind of business advice, you know, going forward. So I'd teach people, you know, absolutely on, you know, some historical lesson and how that frankly guides our future today. If you think about it a little differently,
that's awesome. The challenge.
You got to think differently.
Right. Last question. Okay. You ready? Big one. How do you define success?
Well, I think in any stage of your career, you should be able to look back and you could even do this in high school. You could do this in college. At any stage of life, I think you could look back and say, did I give this 100%? Was I vested? Was I engaged? Was I focused? And it's the effort, you know, that you should look back and say, man, that was a successful time in high school. That was a successful relationship. May end one day. That's okay. You know, you date a few folks. It's okay. But, you know, college. And I look back and I could say that sometimes I wasn't 100% vested. We talked about that, right? But once I corrected and felt, you know, engaged in what I was doing, you know, I could say any of those things, you know, define success. And then it builds. And one day you're going to look back at 20 years and say, you know, how did I do as a founder, owner of a company? Or how did I do as a, you know, husband or, you know, father and things like that? And I do believe it really is the simple things. Are you engaged? You know, are you vested? You know, are you focused? And it's tough to balance time in life always. But if you could look back at any stage and say that, you know, you gave it your all, I think that's success.
Well, Bryce, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate talking with you and your
great questions.
Great time.
Enjoyed it, Charlie. Thank you so much for keep doing it, man. This is a great format. Well done.